Hello, and welcome to Season 7 of the Dementia Researcher iStart Relay podcast. In this series, members of the iStart's professional interest areas interview each other about their PIAs and the hot topics in their fields. Each guest then becomes the next episode's host, passing the conversation along from one researcher to the next. We're releasing one episode a day in the run-up to the Alzheimer's Association International Conference, this year in London and online, showcasing the work of the iStart PIAs. Thank you for listening.
Hello, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Carla Abdelnour, and I'm a clinician scientist. I work at the memory unit of the Hospital São Pau in Barcelona, Spain. I also work on the Clinical Trials Advancement and Methods PIA as vice chair, and I will start my role as chair after AAIC this year. Today, I'm delighted to be talking with Vanessa Young from the Technology and Dementia PIA. Hi, Vanessa. How are you?
Hi, Carla. Thank you. It's lovely meeting you and congratulations. My name, again, as you mentioned, is Vanessa Young. I am a postdoc at the Glenn Biggs Institute for Alzheimer's and Neurodegenerative Disease at UT Health San Antonio in San Antonio, Texas, United States, working under the mentorship of Dr. Sudha Seshadri. And fun fact, I just finished my PhD in May in translational science. So this is a really fun moment for me. And I also serve as the communications chair for the technology and dementia PIA, which is the group I am representing today.
Well, congratulations on finishing your PhD. That is always a milestone, and I'm sure you have done an amazing job. And actually, before we start talking about your PIA, I was wondering if you can talk us a little bit more about your research.
So I study sleep and the aging brain, of course. And what pulled me into it is that the relationship seems to go both ways. And when I started studying sleep, I didn't know, but it's actually very complicated and complex to study sleep. We have known for a long time that as dementia develops, people's sleep gets worse. But it looks like it runs in the other direction too, that poor sleep might actually feed back into that disease itself. So there is this idea, and we are still, you know, researching it, that sleep is when the brain sort of clean the house, clearing out the waste, including some of those proteins that are linked to Alzheimer's disease. And I always like to make the analogy is like a dishwasher that removes all the debris from the dirt dishes. So you can kind of picture a bit of a loop where bad sleep and brain changes feed each other over time. And so that's why it's complicated, but also, for my side, very exciting to study. And honestly, either way you look at it, it tells you the same thing, that sleep is worth exploring and study well, because it might be somewhere that we can actually sleep in and step in and help for intervention, for example. And so the frustration, I think, sometimes is that what we know about sleep and dementia, especially at the population level, is often through subjective measurements because of the cost. Sometimes we ask about, the questions are limited to, for example, sleep durations. Not that that is not important, but is also one variables of sleep. But sleep, again, has many other features that needs to be studied that contribute to that complexity. And for my development as a career progression, I am incorporating that digital measurement. And that's why I am part of the tech and dementia PIA.
That's so cool. I think researching about sleep is super important. We spend a lot of our lifetime sleeping, so it must be a very important process, right? Can you tell us a little bit more about How do you get interested in studying sleep? How do you arrive to that particular field?
I think it was a little bit from being here at the Glambix Institute, because one of my co-workers was doing a study on sleep with respect of Parkinson's disease, which that population is usually develops REM sleep behavior disorder and other sleep disturbances decades before their motor disturbances. And in addition, there is some of the personal side. So when I was myself young, I was myself developed with a neurological disorders that is very much sensitive to sleep. And so back then, I learned that sleep is very important. So that's my personal side. And then as I became involved within the research, and in I think it was in 2019, I started working with the military population and TBI, traumatic brain injury. I also observed that they also experience a lot of trouble sleeping, and also that those who did not sleep well had a very hard time recovering from their brain injury and experience more cognitive issues. And so I think then I started thinking, okay, I think sleep has a very important role beside, you know, helping us feel refreshing in the morning. And that's why I started wanted to delve more into that sleep feature.
Sounds super interesting. And yes, so it could be, because it also could be an intervention, as you mentioned. And I was also thinking about, because you mentioned that you just completed your PhD, and I would like to learn more about that. So can you summarize what were the main findings of your PhD?
So for my PhD, I basically delve a little bit more within the realm of sleep duration and blood-based biomarkers. And we looked at pTau181, NFL, GFAP. And what we explore is that there was a correlation disease cross-section analysis. And what we explore is that there was a U-shaped relationship between pTau181, sleep to like long sleep, especially after the 8.5 hours, and pTau181 in specific. But that relationship did not really hold for the other biomarkers. Any specific, for example, NFL was very sensitive to kidney function. So we had two models. In the first model was not adjusted for kidney function, but the second model was. And so we lost that significant in the second model. And so that was very exciting to see. And prior doing this first analysis, we also have done a systematic review to see what was already done, what was already there. And something that I have observed is that a lot of the studies as a community, we are using a lot of the skills are different sometimes. Some people may be using the MOS, some people may be using the PSQI, or within the realm of sleep duration, the cutoffs are different. And when we're looking at the blood-based biomarkers, it's also the way the variables is treated is different. That makes it a little bit difficult then to run a meta-analysis. So that was the part of my presentation and the primary findings.
Great. And what do you think will be then the next steps after these findings? What do you would like to see in the field in the upcoming years?
What I would like to personally see, or what I'm working on, is including more, doing more mixed methods studies where we are including more the subjective measurements, but also pairing more with objective measurements. Like, for example, these digital measurements that right now we have available. And these digital measurements, such as wearables, could be an example, but there are also sleeping mats that could be used, are important because they are passive and they allow you to measure the sleep of each individual in a more continuous way throughout the weeks. And you can also assess the variabilities between one night and the other. You can also check for that sleep fragmentation that is very important. And it also becomes a little bit more accessible for those individuals that don't really live near big centers. Like, we work a lot with people who are in the border regions of Texas. But I have colleagues, for example, who live in the UK, and they have similar instances where if you are near UCL, for example, you have access to big hospital and institution, but if you're more in the rural area, it might be a little bit harder to have access to big centers and go and perform a sleep study. So having these new devices that could be shipped and then we get the data here, is both, I think, great from a research perspective, but as well as from a clinical perspective, because then the providers could mail these devices for capturing their sleep and be used at for diagnostic purposes.
Yes, I think that's a very good point. With digital biomarkers, you can reach different populations that cannot access in person, and you can get very good quality information or data, which is, I think, is super interesting. I also think that digital biomarkers give us so much information. And I was wondering if you can tell us a little bit more on, because I come from the CTMP and we think about methodology. So how do you analyze that volume of data? I think you get so much data. And how can you maybe disentangle what might be meaningful data from the background noise that might not be clinically meaningful?
Are you talking about, for example, if from the wearable device, we have a lot of data that we are capturing, and then how you will be measuring that, all that data?
Yes. Yes, because you get a lot of variables you can measure, right? Is the duration, the variability. There are so many variables. So how do you manage that?
That's a very great question. And right now we are entering the stage with one of our study where we are starting to measure the first cross-sectional data that we collected. And what I can tell you at the moment, what we are trying to understand, what we measure and what we might not be measuring is the first months, for example, we usually do not include because there might be noise. And then we try to align and harmonize for everybody what is their baseline, because not the entire cohort started at the same time. So some people started in October, some people started in November. And then what you can do based on other study, for example, we collaborate with Oregon Health and Science University, who had other and more wide experience with the wearable devices. You can estimate their sleep stages, for example. So you have the continuation, but you can also estimate their sleep stage, which is very important because we know that with the aging process, these sleep stages tend to decrease. Some people do not enter in deep sleep, which becomes a problem. And then see if that sleep is fragmented. That is also something that we want to see. But what the wearable also provide is their heart rate variability. Is there that helps you estimate that the sleep stages and also their breathing. That's something else that is also important. I don't know if that answer your question fully, but it's something that is exciting and complex, and I'm also honest, like I'm learning right now on how to really analyze all the big data. We have more than 100 participants, and yes, with like 40 years of data, and it's scary, exciting and scary at the same time. But I know it will be worthwhile, and it will provide a lot of insight.
Yes, that sounds super exciting, although complex for sure. But I think that's a very good way to get to personalized medicine, right? Because it's the measure for that person at that time. And we can actually monitor people. It's not that you come to one visit and I see you in 3 months or think 6 months. So it's daily changes. And I think that that's very exciting. Although, of course, the amount of data might be very complex. And actually, I think that's a really good segue to my next question, because I would like to know, Vanessa, what are the really hot topics and exciting areas in your field at this moment?
That's a great question. I think that there is so much happening right now. I think that one part absolutely that excited me the most is that, as we discussed, that sleep is one of the, obviously, the earliest windows into that brain health, because we know that when we don't sleep well, we don't feel ourselves, and we are slower, or we are not able to pay attention to ourselves, even if we don't necessarily have cognitive decline. And with these wearables, we can finally capture it at home. And like you said, in a continuous way, so that we don't have any missed data when these changes are actually occurring with relation to other symptoms. And so that's definitely exciting. And what is also important is that these measurements are occurring at their homes and not in an artificial environment. And that is important. That's why we also removed those first months sometimes, because otherwise they might be biased, because they know they're wearing a wearable now. And so we want them kind of forget, like we don't want them to know. And after a while you get used to it and you don't think anymore that you are wearing that device, and it becomes part of you. And again, we are also able to measure other components like the breathing, the heart patterns, and the movements, the physical activities that is so much related to brain health. And long ago, I think that was almost like a fiction. And the other big shift to me is that, and not an expert by any mean, I just learned about this through a colleague. There is a shift going from wearables to something called nearables. And it's basically adding sensors in the mattress or routers in the room, so that the participants are not wearing anything at all. And that is important for two things, because you forget more at faster rate that you are part of a research study, so it removes that bias, but it also removes the burden to the participants. So you don't need to charge the devices. You don't need to remember that, oh, I need to put my watch on this charger because the data needs to be deployed to the platform that the researchers are using. And especially for our populations who might be, having memory problems, releasing that task for them is very important. Now, on the other hand, the question I have and I want to learn more is this feasible? Is this accepted? Because I don't know what entails to have a radar in the home, or are people happy to have this kind of devices at home? Does it mean I need to put a nail in the walls? Are there any damages? I don't know. So that's the part that I'm curious, but I learned recently, and I think that's a very hot topic, and I think it will be able to collect more quality data, because if I don't forget to charge my phone, when I forget to charge the wearable, then I don't get data. What else? If that is continuous, then it's some more on the researcher than on the participant. There is not interruption. And then definitely there is a lot of talk on that digital equity, because oftentimes when we work with these wearables, the participant needs Wi-Fi, for example. Otherwise, you don't receive the data. And so how can we make this study where technology is involved more open to everyone, so that if you don't have Wi-Fi, you can, what can I do as a researcher to ensure that those who may have financial restraint or other issue because of the location and maybe internet is not there anymore can be still part of the study. So those are, I think, the hot topics, because then otherwise we have sampling convenience bias in research.
That sounds super interesting. Thank you very much. I also was wondering if there is anything about using AI for analyzing the data or trying to capture what might be meaningful data. Do you know if anything that might be doing somebody or a group that is using AI or a type of agent for studying sleep?
So I'm not yet, although I know with the technology in Dementiapedia, this year we are really focusing on AI. And a lot of my coworkers, especially within the clinical field, are looking into AI. For example, on how to score the PhD, for example, that's one of the parts. And creating learning models for estimating who might be a higher risk of dementia based on the data that has been captured. However, that's the stand on the knowledge I have right now with specific AI. It's definitely a area that I plan on growing. And that's why I'm excited to be part of the PIA. But I have a lot of expertise in that area.
I think that's the perfect segue for my next question, because I think you're maybe in the best peer, right, in the technology peer, because you're interested in digital biomarkers, but also AI. So I want to know, Vanessa, how does the work of your peer support your field of research right now?
I think in a way, my field just is like technology and dementia, the two. So this PIA is where everything is basically happening. That's the way I see it. Is where the methods, people and the research people, the statisticians and the clinicians, as well as industry people, are meeting and are having a big conversations on how we can further the field. And that matters because the hard problems sometimes is the validations, the algorithms, the equity of access, as we mentioned, the data standards. And I don't think that we can solve these problems if we work in isolation. So we need really to work as a group together. And there is something personal in this for me as well, because the technology and Dementiapedia grew out exactly the kind of in-home sensing research I now do. So in a real sense, if you like, that community really helped build the field I'm working right now. So this PIA was funded by Dr. Jeffrey Kay, and is the one who started first deploying all this part platform with all the at-home sensors and the devices and the wearables, and with whom I now collaborate from Texas, and his group is in Oregon. So it's great. It has been definitely doing a lot for the work I do here.
Definitely. I think you mentioned that it has helped you network with other people and also It seems like a very collaborative environment. We do need different people with different perspectives to tackle these questions. And to dig a little bit more about yourself, I would like to know what brought you to the technology field. How did you get involved?
I think it started with, again, the people that I mentioned. So it was back in 2022 when I started working here at the Glambix Institute, and we launched what we call the Compadre Study, which is at home-based technology study where we have sensors and clinical measurements. And this study was initiated by Dr. Gonzalez in collaboration with OrcaTech at Oregon Health and Science University. And that's where I became very acquainted with, and now I call them family and friends, with Dr. Jeffrey Kay and also Allison Linder. And 2 years later, then I attended my first Alzheimer's Association International Conference. And I saw when you registered that there was a pre-conference, and I was like, okay, I guess I will attend. This seems relevant to me. I will go. And I remember I was terrified because I didn't know anybody. I was very new to the field. And then when I entered, I was like, oh, I know a couple of faces. And then I became more involved, and we continued to work with Jeff. And then last year they told me, it's like, hey, just, you know, the elections are coming up. If you like to nominate yourself, I think you would be a good candidate for the communications chair. Why don't you give it a try? And I was like, oh, there is no way anybody's going to vote me, but here I am. So that's how I became more involved with tech at Dementia Pia.
That sounds amazing. Yes, I think what we have discussed previously also is that the PIAs give you the opportunity to meet people and also collaborate with different people. So it's a great platform to do your research. So if you have a particular interest, just join one of the groups. There are a lot of opportunities in different groups, and the technology PIA is one of them. I think I'm a member, but my calendar is too busy. But definitely, I will check out what you will be doing, Vanessa, because I love tech stuff. It's just that, yeah, I have very different interests. So I'll try to make some room in my schedule to follow you guys also. And on that note, I want to know, what are the plans that the technology PIA has for AIC in London?
We actually have a very busy schedule in London. Again, I think the technology dementia PIA and the neuroimaging is the only two PIAs that have a full day pre-conference. Don't quote me on that, but I think the others have like more PIA day or things. But so very excited. So our flagship is the pre-conference that is Saturday, July 11th, which is the day before AIC opens. And it's, again, it's a full day. And the theme this year involves AI, as I mentioned earlier. And we open with a keynote using AI and the smartwatch data to see if we can detect Parkinson's disease earlier. And then following that series, we have a data blitz. So from when people submit their abstracts to AIC, then they can select whether or not they want their poster, their abstract to be considered for the Tech and Dementia pre-conference. So they will present twice. So we have selected, 76 for the pre-conference. And from those, then we select a few for a data blitz, which is a rapid fire talks. And it's specifically for early career researchers and includes also PhD students. And then we select a winner. And so for anyone who is listening for the next one, so be sure that you select that pre-conference if your topic is relevant to the tech and dementia sphere. After that, we have a scientific section on wearables in the wild, sleep, activity, and multimodal sensing, which is very much, you know, the corner of my world. So I'm very excited to meet other scientists. And then I also get to moderate a panel right before the lunchtime on scaling dementia technologies, bringing industry and academic voices together, which is also very important because I think we need to come together. And then the other part that is very new and exciting is that it's new for this year. We wanted to involve more attendees. So the whole afternoon is on AI again and dementia research. And instead of just having expert talks, we built in small group interactive breakout sessions so that the attendees are not just listening, especially after lunch, and then you kind of like fall asleep. So they actually work collaborative throughout with questions on things like harmonization and AI-enabled trial design. And then the groups report back and we pull out the takeaways as a room. So again, we designed that with in purpose to involve the audience more. And I just want to also to highlight that the pre-conference is in person only. And it requires a separate registration from the regular AIC conference.
Well, you will be super busy then, right, Vanessa? There is a lot of things happening during AIC, all of which sounds super exciting. So I will definitely check out some of those. I think you mentioned that you will be talking about trials and AI. Since I'm from the trials PI, we need to talk offline for sure. I'm definitely interested in learning more about that.
Yeah, I wanted to mention, like, we actually, wearables and devices can be included in clinical trials because you can assess continuously other kind of outcomes in addition to, you know, pharmaceutical outcome, like related to the drugs. There are more outcomes that could be assessed. So definitely we should chat.
Thank you very much. So it's time to start finishing our podcast today. But before I go, I do have a final question for you, Vanessa. I want to know, what advice do you have for someone who is just learning about iStart, and how has it helped you being involved?
I will say, I want to link back to that first feeling that I had when I first attended AIC. And I know that a lot of people probably have shared that feeling of being scared and a little bit lost. AIC is very big. But after you join the conference, after a while, you see that it's always, you know, the same people. It's the same community and everybody's very friendly. But you know, everybody thinks, who am I? And they will not want me because I'm not experienced enough. And that's exactly they think that I want people not to think of because you do not get involved in the PIA because you already belong, but you belong because you get involved in the PIA. So my advice is really simple. Just, you know, start with one PIA that it's of your most interest, and then go to one webinar and then say, you know, say hi if you go in person, and then you start building your network. And I will say this, I guess, personally for somebody that, you know, I'm not traditional students, I started earlier, and it was very difficult to channel at the beginning, but again, I do strongly believe that this entire community provides a lot of opportunities, including being here today. When I first joined, I was like, wow, these people are so amazing. There is no way I'm going to be here. And today I was invited. I thank you, Dementia Researcher, for their trust and their patience. And I get to meet you. And so I think it's wonderful, and just provide your inputs. And you might not be the, you know, the super expert with 40 years of experience, but you do have some expertise and can give some to the community.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Vanessa. I think you're an amazing person, and I congratulate you for all the work that you're doing. I think that's an amazing advice for people that want to join. I think you're a testament to what you can build by joining APIA and work on your network. It can really help you to move your research forward. So I thank you for your time today. So this is the end of our podcast today. Thank you very much to the listeners, and see you at AAIC in London.
See you, Carla. Thank you so much for having me and be a wonderful host. I look forward to meeting you in person.
Me too.
You have been listening to the Relay Podcast, delivered as a collaboration between Dementia Researcher and iStart. This podcast is made at University College London with generous funding from the NIHR, Race Against Dementia, Alzheimer's Association, Alzheimer's Research UK, and the Alzheimer's Society. Please like and subscribe and share your thoughts in the comments.